about historic and persistent colonialism and the responsibility that comes with their privilege. I will use my voice to speak up, and I will make more space at the table.
I will continue to educate myself and others in my community about the racism and inequities faced by BIPOC.
We will not be silent and idle.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
Today on Wings.
For thousands of years, we've been able to farm this beautiful planet. For millions of years, we've evolved as a species, knowing we are one among many. And yet, we've nearly lost the capacity to live as part of the Earth family, and with it, the capacity to survive as a species.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Dr. Vandana Shiva was born to a forest conservationist father and a farming mother. She holds an MA in philosophy and a PhD in the theory of quantum physics. She is the founder of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, and Navdanya, an institute that works to protect India's natural biodiversity. On October 20th, 2014, she spoke in Berkeley, California. You will hear now the first part of that speech. The second part will be released in a later program.
I've grown up in a culture where the word Vasudeva Kutumbakam is used all the time, every day, that we are part of the Earth family. Vasundhara is the Earth, and Kutumbakam is a family. We've grown up being told that the universe is for all beings, not just for the human species, definitely not for 1% of the human species. And there's an ancient text, an Upanishad, which puts it into such tight conceptual framework that the universe is for the benefit of all beings. No one being has the right to take away the ecological space from other species or future generations. This was the basis on which Gandhi said, "The earth has enough for everyone's needs, but not for a few people's greed." But for a few hundred years, the greed machinery has built sophisticated structures to make all of society think that nature is dead, people are uncreative, and the fictions we create, like capital, is a creative force. Capital is a construct, and yet we've given it creative power. And taken away the creative power of the universe, taken away the creative power of the earth, and taken away the creative power of people. So the issue of extinction is related very intimately to where do we see creativity to emerge. Does it emerge from constructions, or does it emerge from every part of this planet, every cell in every being? The great illusions of the industrial age, which is also the colonial age, which is also the capitalist age, are first that nature is dead. And right here in this area, you've had Susan Griffin, Caroline Merchant, write so beautifully about the construction of the idea of a dead nature. And if nature is dead, then you can't really kill it. What we have called progress is built on two pillars. One pillar is mechanistic science, the idea that the world is made of objects, lifeless objects, unrelated to each other. And even though the best of science today, whether it comes from biology or it comes from quantum theory, is teaching us that that idea of separation is very false, that we live in a non-separable world. We live in a web of life. We live in a world where one action in one place has huge impact. And what could make this clearer than the fact that the fossil fuel use of the industrialized world is making the glaciers retreat in the Himalaya, where no one uses fossil fuel. The Ganges Glacier is retreating at 20 meters a year. Last year, we had such extreme rain in 2 days, the 16th and 17th of June, 350% more than normal. The glaciers were already melting and lakes had formed. With this heavy rain, the lakes burst. I come from a very beautiful part of the Himalaya where the Ganges originates. The region is called Chardham. It's also called Devbhumi. Devbhumi means the place of the gods. Chardham is the pilgrimage to the five tributaries of the Ganges, each of which is a goddess, each of which has a temple at the source. And it's been a protected region because these rivers were seen as sources of life. A few years ago, partly because of climate change, suddenly there was a spate of dam building because dams are now defined as a clean development mechanism. And when you build a dam, you can get money. 500 dams are planned on the Ganges. About 30 have been built. Dams as well as hydroelectric projects. And the state was renamed from Devbhumi, the land of the divine, to Urja Pradesh, the land of energy. Hydroelectric power. Well, these 15-kilometer, 30-kilometer tunnels that are built excavate the mountain. They blast with dynamite. And when this flood came last year, all of that debris in the river was carried with the flood waters, and our rivers, river beds, rose by 40 feet in some places, which meant that villages that were sitting safe were now washed away. Bridges that were 30 feet above the water were washed away. 20,000 people died. None of them had caused the instability of which they were a victim. And this interconnectedness then creates a collective responsibility. How do we start building that collective responsibility? Partly by becoming more real about the world in which we are. More real about a planet that is alive. More real about the fact that we are members of the Earth family. More real about the fact that every species has rights. And when we've built a mechanistic science, a reductionist paradigm based on fragmentation and separation, of course, no species have rights. They're just objects to be manipulated. And this idea of the ultimate manipulation has reached its peak, the idea of genetic engineering. The claim is that this is the next step of the so-called Green Revolution. The Green Revolution, as I've said often, was not green and not revolutionary. It was just a clever way to deploy war chemicals to agriculture. And very often, it has been said, India's food doubled and tripled. Now, all that happened is instead of growing a diversity of crops, we grew rice in one season and wheat in one season. If all you grow is rice, you'll have more rice. It doesn't matter what the seed is like. So what was made a miracle seed was not really a miracle. It was the result of having more irrigation and putting more land under a crop. Native varieties of seeds have everything going for them. The only thing is they don't like chemicals. So when you apply chemicals, they have a habit of lodging. I call it the force of truth of the plant saying, go away, chemicals, I don't want you. But instead of saying chemicals are wrong, we don't need them in agriculture, the chemical industry said, let's change the plant. And they made them dwarf so they could absorb chemical fertilizers more. But it needed more water, 10 times more water. Norman Borlaug called the 12 people he sent out to distribute these seeds and push the chemicals. He called them his 12 apostles. And now there are people writing about Norman Borlaug being declared a saint. Borlaug got a Nobel Peace Prize for spreading these seeds and chemicals. But I got involved in agriculture because of the violence in Punjab 30,000 people were killed. Punjab was a land of war. Today, Punjab has lost its water. People give about 5 to 10 years more of the drilling. They've gone down some places to 1,000 feet. The soils are dead. Farmers are dying. Some because they're getting cancer. There's actually a train that leaves Punjab called the cancer train. It's got the name cancer train. And they have to leave in a train because there's a hospital that's charitable that's been built in Rajasthan by the Jains. But the others are dying because of debt. The argument has been made that genetically engineered seeds are the second green revolution. And if the myth of the green revolution works, then the myth of the second green revolution should also work. The difference is that when the green revolution started to make the Punjab farmers pay a price with their very lives, it's only they who knew. And that's why they took to arms and guns and created the protests that then led to the army being sent to the Golden Temple. Today with GMOs, everyone gets connected. It's not just an issue of a little part, one little region called Punjab. I'm sure most of you don't even know that Punjab had violence. Most of you probably don't know that 6 times more people were killed in Punjab than in 9/11. And that the injustice to the people of Punjab carries on because the military was sent, then Indira Gandhi was assassinated, and then the 3,006 were killed in a pogrom. And the justice still hasn't been done. The same year we had the Bhopal disaster, and there too no justice has been done. It's the 30th anniversary. It's a good moment to remember that the poisons that are made to look inevitable in agriculture were never meant for food systems. They were meant to kill human beings, and they're killing human beings another life. Because I did a study on the Green Revolution, I got involved in the genetic engineering debate through a conference in 1987 organized in Geneva, where the industry laid out, the old agrochemical industry said, we've got to genetically engineer the seed in order to take patents on seed, and we've got to do this worldwide, so we've got to have a world intellectual property rights law. Monsanto later admitted that they wrote that law. They said, we were the patient, diagnostician, physician, all in one. We defined a problem, and what was the problem? That farmers save seeds. And they offered a solution, and the solution was seed saving should be made an intellectual property crime. Now, at that meeting, they really had hoped by the year 2000, GMOs would have taken over the whole world. But we started to build movements for seed freedom and seed sovereignty. And that meant both with love, taking care of every seed we could find, and making sure farmers could have the seeds to grow food without chemicals, without debt. I regret that I did not look at fiber at that time. I looked at food. So we saved food crops and vegetables and pulses. Monsanto came in with the GM cotton. And it came in illegally. It entered India illegally as it enters most countries illegally. Entered Brazil illegally. It's entering Bangladesh illegally. Because legally, it's not so easy. We have laws. In most of the world. The only country that doesn't have laws for biosafety. Biosafety is an assessment of environmental impact, public health impact, and socioeconomic impact in the context of genetically engineered organisms. There's a United Nations treaty on this, and when we got the article in the Convention on Biological Diversity, it's Article 19.3, President Bush Sr. walked out and said, I won't let my biotech industry lose profits, and came back, and then I always laugh and I think of Dan Quayle because he couldn't spell potato, but he did manage to spell substantial equivalence, which is the assumption that genetically engineered organisms are like parent organisms. There's no difference. And therefore, you don't have to look, you don't have to see, you'll never find impact, and you declare safety. There is no law in this country on assessment of genetically modified organisms. No law at all. The BT crops have been approved as a pesticide. And the industry sends a note to the government to say, we're bringing this variety, approve it. That's how the new Dow varieties that are resistant to 2,4-D have been recently introduced. Of course, the interesting thing is that the same companies, when it comes to safety, they say just like nature made it. And when it comes to ownership, they say never existed in nature before, totally our invention. I've called this ontological schizophrenia. You've split the world into two for the same object. New when it comes to owning, natural when it comes to running away from taking responsibility of the impacts. We've seen the impacts now in 20 years. The first impact is, of course, the fact of two applications, BT toxin crops and herbicide tolerant crops. Neither of them have succeeded. One has created super pests, the other has created super weeds, and American agriculture is a good evidence of the failure with 17 million acres under super weeds. In India, the impact is the fact that because GMOs have only one objective, there might be a claim that they are about feeding the world, the reality is it's about collecting royalties. And it's collecting royalties from what nature does. Because nature reproduces one generation of seed. That work is not done by the gene that was introduced. Life makes itself. And in the case of life, the idea of intellectual property rights is such a deep violation of the rights of nature. It's a violation of the rights of farmers, and it is increasingly in this country becoming a violation of rights of all citizens. It's a violation of nature because what is being claimed as property is the reproductive capacity of living organisms.
On Wings, you're listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, speaking in Berkeley, California, in October 2014.
Besides building movements, besides going to courts, I also went to Geneva to talk to ambassadors and say, you know, this is what your intellectual property rights looks like. It allows companies to steal from other cultures. And I remember the ambassador of the U.S. said, we are committed to defining life as a manufacturer because this is where the future of the U.S. economy lies. So this very foundational redefinition of taking the mechanistic worldview into life itself has been defined as the area of growth. How does the growth take place? Through intellectual property, through collecting rents and royalties. But that growth is not distributed through society. This idea of a mechanistic worldview is now being imposed at a time where science tells you that it's about relationships. That's where creativity is taking place in all life, including human life. What has been done is a trick I call the imposition of a creation boundary. You just decide that nature doesn't create, people don't create, capital enters, and suddenly there's creation. And this has made a difference to how we live our lives, but it's the foundations of the economic theory. Just the other day, I was trying to make sense of how is it that we've reached a place where we declare capital, which is a construct, as the creative force that creates value and wealth, and nature has been reduced to land, which is just a commodity and a dead input, and people have been reduced to labor, which is another inert input. We need to turn that equation on its head. Nature's creative, people are creative. Capital is another word for money, and money is a means which should be subjected to higher values. And I would say the same for technology. I mean, the two tools, two means, money and technology, have been elevated to creative forces of the universe. And the creative forces of the universe have been dumped into a garbage can. And no wonder we have so much destruction. No wonder we have so much exploitation. No wonder we have the death of democracy. In terms of the technology tool, genetic engineering can do nothing without a living organism. It doesn't create the living organism, it has to use a living organism. And the living organism is usually seed stolen from someone else.
On Wings, you're listening to Vandana Shiva, who led a successful campaign from 1997 to 2001 to quash a company's patent on India's famous basmati rice.
I've had to deal with patents on basmati, but also a patent on wheat. Everyone now has gluten allergies. But we've eaten wheat throughout human history. And in India, we still have wheats that don't contribute to gluten allergy. There's a silencing gene. So Monsanto, of course, thought, what a brilliant market. Patent these old varieties. And the patent said, the wheat, all products are made of the wheat, the dough made from the wheat, the cookies made of the wheat. And they had hoped to capture a global market. But we challenged the patent. And in this case, we didn't even have to fight. We had to do no arguments. We had no court case. They ran. They dropped the patent and ran. But it doesn't mean that biopiracy has stopped. Because of the fear of climate change, of course, there's a premium on crops that are resilient to drought and floods and salt that comes from the oceans during hurricanes and cyclones. And I remember an ad that had been put in all the newspapers and magazines by Monsanto saying, climate change, 9 billion people, what now? And then they moved on to say only they can create climate resilience. They can't create climate resilience. Climate resilience is a multi-genetic trait. Genetic engineering can only move genes. The technology is crude. Most people don't know that gene transfer takes place through only two steps of violence against the cells of an organism. One is shooting with a gene gun, and the other is infecting with a plant cancer. And it's a very uncertain technology. You don't know if it'll succeed. That's why you have antibiotic resistance markers, viral promoters, all evidence that you don't know what you're doing. And yet they say the most accurate, precise technology ever. In the case of climate resilience, because in Navdanya we save seeds, when these claims started that, we are making salt-tolerant seeds for the first time, we started putting out lists of all the salt-tolerant seeds we have that have been bred by farmers, given by nature, evolved by farmers. When the supercyclone hit Orissa, 30,000 people killed, we were able to rejuvenate agriculture through these salt-tolerant seeds. And then the farmers of Orissa gave two truckloads to the farmers of Tamil Nadu during the tsunami. Indonesian farmers took these salt-tolerant seeds. Burmese farmers wanted them, but the junta at that time didn't allow the giving of the seeds. So climate-resilient traits are not an invention of the biotech industry. And I feel very proud that our patent office rejected a Monsanto application for climate resilience. They said, you've invented nothing. There is, of course, huge pressure. There's something called Special 301 in your trade law, which is an act that can threaten us. We are being threatened right now, and our Prime Minister and Mr. Obama signed an agreement that we will do something with our intellectual property rights of the kind that allow us to say to Monsanto, sorry, you didn't invent salt tolerance or stress tolerance or climate resilience. But there are 1,500 patents by the five companies that control the chemicals and now the seeds for climate resilience. So if they don't breed climate-resilient crops, what do they do? They've now moved to big data. Everywhere you hear the talk of big data. So big data is they take seeds from gene banks where it's very clearly written on the passport data, salt-tolerant, drought-tolerant, flood-tolerant. So they know this. Seeds have these traits. Then they put it through reading the genome in some totally mechanical computer act. And then as is written, then we make a guess. Which are the 100 winning lottery tickets? Because they're making a guess of what part of the genome contributes to the trait. They don't know. They're betting. They've turned life to a casino. And they're taking patents on this betting. If Wall Street brought the world down in 2008 with a financial casino, can you imagine what the implications are if seed is allowed to be in the hands of those who have no idea what that seed is? And not only is it about monopoly on seed, Monsanto's just bought up the biggest climate data corporation, Climate Corp. They bought up the world's biggest soil data corporation because the vision is a huge centralized system where every farmer at every point will have to buy information. And with that information, the particular patented seed. It would be a bad idea even if it worked. But it can't work because nature's so diverse, soils are diverse, our crops are diverse, the seasons are changing. And it's only adaptation at the local level that's able to respond. Not a centralized system where big data becomes the means of control. because of WTO and globalization, all that used to be measured is how much grain is in container ships. You know, when WTO says we'll increase trade by 200 billion, all they're doing is measuring the up and down. They're not measuring how much is growing, and they're not measuring how much is being eaten. Now, in terms of being eaten, it now turns out that 70% of the food people eat grows in small farms, family farms, and gardens. And this, in spite of the fact that for 50 years, all we've had is policies for pushing corporate-controlled industrial agriculture. In spite of that, 70% food comes from the small. Look at the data. Russia, 56% family farms produce 90% of the potatoes, 55% of the milk. In Brazil, 87% of the beans and milk come from small farms. Cuba, it's 98%. Ukraine, 55%. You could go through every country. Most of the food eaten by people comes from small farms. Small farms are the base of food security. We've done a lot of work saving seeds, growing biodiversity, and a few years ago, we started to calculate the nutrition that was being produced. We called it health per acre. And we can feed two Indias by conserving biodiversity. The world could feed two times the population. That issue of scarcity and then, you know, 10 billion, 9 billion, get scared, accept GMOs, is so out of tune with what the facts are. Now, while industrial farming produces only 30% of the food, and GMO corn and soya only 10%, they are destroying 75% of the planet. 75% biodiversity has been eroded because of industrial monocultures. This is United Nations Plant Genetic Resources Convention in 1995. From 95 to now, it's worse because we've had globalization and spread larger monocultures. 70% of the water, 75% of the water is misused. I would not say used. Misused in industrial farming. Misused both because plants don't need that level of water, but also because the runoff that carries the chemicals is then creating the dead zones. Soil degradation because of chemical industrial farming. 40% of the greenhouse gases, the combination of carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxide from nitrogen fertilizers, methane from factory farming, as well as the fact that this globalized system of an agriculture based on uniformity is wasting 50% of the food. And that food also goes into waste dumps, garbage dumps, and emits methane. 40% of the climate problem is related to how we are violating the rights of the earth in how we grow our food. And in the process, not feeding people either, 1 billion people are hungry, 2 billion suffering from diseases related to bad food.
You have been listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, scientist, feminist, and ecological activist, October 20th, 2014, in Berkeley, California. The second part will be released in a later program. The website for the Navdanya Institute is www.navdanya.org. Wings thanks radio station KPFA for use of its audio. For Wings, I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson in Berkeley, California.
Tune in next week for the rest of Vandana Shiva's powerful speech in California.
We'll have to be more brilliant than we've ever been, more resilient than we've ever been, more courageous than we've ever been.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please like our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wing sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit SCWIST.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.